You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening to all of you. It's my name is Steve Hubbell. I'm with the Open Society Fellowship Program. And it's a special treat for us to be able to welcome you to this event. Beck Hamilton was one of our first Open Society Fellows. She was among the very first to deliver to her publisher a manuscript of publishable quality, and therefore the first to have, among the first, Evgeny Morozov was the first yesterday evening to have a book party in her honor. And we are delighted to be present as the ideas that gestated during her Open Society Fellowship are being launched into the public conversation. And I would urge you all to pick up a copy of Fighting for Darfur, which will be on sale, which is on sale now and will be on sale after the event at this table over here. And Beck has indicated an eager willingness to sign copies. The Open Society Fellowship exists to bring ideas into our network that will challenge us, inspire us, redirect our efforts, amplify them, and Beck has been exemplary in every one of those regards. I'd also like to welcome our distinguished panel of discussants for Beck's book. We have Dr. Mohammed Ahmed Abdallah, Fabienne Hara, Jehan Henry, and I want to extend a special debt of gratitude to our colleague Jerry Fowler, Senior Policy Analyst for Multilateral Affairs at the Open Society Foundation's office in Washington. He came up from Washington this afternoon, especially for this event, and we're most grateful to him for doing so. His previous post as the head of the Save Darfur organization equips him, I think, uniquely to preside over the issues to be raised in this panel tonight. And without further ado, I'll turn it over with thanks to Jerry.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, and thanks to all of you for coming out this evening. It's an honor for me to be here and to be able to moderate a panel with four people whose work has been illuminating to me over the years. And I don't know if my previous job uniquely qualifies me to preside over this or uniquely disqualifies me, but nevertheless, it's an honor to be here. The crisis in Darfur sparked a virtually unprecedented public response, first here in the United States and then abroad. It started welling up, even though the crisis, we should be clear, first the crisis is decades long, but involved intense violence from 2003. This public response started welling up in the United States in 2004 and eventually coalesced around the Save Darfur Coalition. Although I should be clear that this public movement on Darfur has never been, is not now, and certainly wasn't in the years that are covered in Beck's book, a monolithic movement where there's carefully orchestrated decisions made by some central controlling intelligence. But the movement did coalesce around the Save Darfur Coalition, and then globally, the movement a year or so later found its organization and direction, its international dimension in a coalition called Globe for Darfur. Quite apart from all of the debates about the situation in Darfur itself, the growth of this public movement, this constituency of conscience, has engendered itself a lot of passionate debate, the goods, the bads, the pros, the cons. Some of this debate very well informed, some of it not so well informed. And so Beck undertook, as part of her Open Society Fellowship, to analyze this movement and the goods and the bads, the pros and the cons. And I should say, I don't think Steve mentioned this, but the idea of the Open Society Fellowships, which the Open Society is very proud of, is to attract and support idea entrepreneurs from across the world who will ask hard questions and challenge conventional wisdom. And I think that's what Beck has done in her book. To discuss it, before you all rush to the table to buy it, we're going to have Beck say a few words. I should say, in addition to being an Open Society Fellow, she's now a fellow at the New America Foundation and also has been working as a special correspondent for the Washington Post with support from the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting, which has allowed her to go back to Sudan, back and forth, I guess, numerous times. She'll speak and provide an overview of her research, which is in Fighting for Darfur, and did I mention that it's available at the table in the back? And then after that, Dr. Mohammed Ahmed will speak. He is the founder of the Amal Center for the Treatment of Victims of Torture in Niala, in Darfur, although now, because of the situation on the ground in Darfur, he's living in Boston as a refugee. He is the winner in 2007 of the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Human Rights Award and is truly a brave and resourceful fighter for human rights. We'll have Jahan Henry, who is the Sudan researcher at Human Rights Watch, and before joining Human Rights Watch, was in El Fasher in North Darfur as a human rights officer with the United Nations. And then last but certainly not least, Fabian Ara, who is the vice president for multilateral affairs for the crisis group, who directs all of their activities here in New York and has worked on Africa for much longer than you would think to look at her, but for years and years and years. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Beck.
I need to, oh no, it turns on itself, magic.
Voice activated.
Okay, so hi everyone, thank you so much for coming out this evening. It's a new thing for me, having spent, you know, the past 4 years just doing the research and writing, to actually be talking about some of the takeaways of the book. And it's complicated, and it's supposed to be complicated because the situation is complicated. So I thought I would just try to distill a few of the key points. But before I start, I want to take a giant step back for the people that are not immersed in this world, who are in the audience, and say that mass atrocities, whether or not they fall under the legal definition of genocide, have been occurring forever and ever and ever. But it was with a huge amount of hope at the start of this century, and in this country in particular, that people started galvanizing around a theory. And the theory was that if U.S. citizens created a massive outcry, they could push the U.S. government, and the U.S. government could stop these atrocities continuing to occur. That theory came out of a very particular time and place. America, in this sort of unique window between the end of the Cold War and before 9/11. And it was very much a product of its time. U.S. power, both hard power and soft power, were at a peak. And it was sort of seen that if America just wanted to badly enough, then it could almost do anything. It was also the product of counterfactual thinking. Having looked at situations of genocide and mass atrocity over the course of the 20th century and seeing what were the ingredients that were missing. And clearly one of the ingredients that was missing was an outcry from the American people. And so the counterfactual thinking of, if you could just put that missing ingredient in, then maybe instead of failure, you would have success. Now, one of the things about counterfactuals is they're very hard to ever disprove. We don't know. It may be the case that had, and this is for people who are immersed in the advocacy community, you will know the story well. It may have been the case that had every member of the U.S. Congress received 100 letters from their constituents as the crisis in Rwanda was developing in 1994, then the U.S. government might have acted to stop the killings. We, in actual fact, don't know, but in many ways the Save Darfur movement was pinned on the assumption that counterfactual was undoubtedly true. We don't know, for example, had the U.S. government with respect to Rwanda gone out and led the world by calling it genocide in the early days of the crisis, if the world would have rallied around and done something to prevent the unfolding massacres. But again, the Save Darfur movement was founded on the assumption that this was in fact true. And so a theme that you'll see consistently if you read the book is that Darfur was in many ways an example of fighting the last war. It was trying to fight genocides throughout the 20th century, but in particular Rwanda, and the lessons learned from that became articles of faith for the new Darfur community. And, you know, we still don't know those answers on Rwanda. What we do know is that the 100 letters that every member of the U.S. Congress did in fact receive on Darfur was not enough to enable the U.S. government to solve the crisis there. Because Darfur became this massive movement, it attracted a lot of commentary, and two polarizing views emerged. One, in essence, was people who supported advocacy, who wanted to claim that advocacy was responsible for everything good that had ever happened in Darfur, indeed probably in Sudan as a whole. On the other side, you had people who are critics of the mass movement saying not only was it responsible for everything bad that was going on, but at its extreme, it was even complicit in part of the war on terror. And the idea of the book really was to try and get into the policy black box a little bit and to see how decisions were taken, figuring that having that factual basis would be a useful start in determining what impact advocacy did or did not have. And getting inside the policy black box is useful, and just time for one of my favorite in a negative sort of way, anecdotes from the book in terms of the original genocide determination that the U.S. government made. Looking from the outside at the time, and again against this backdrop of Rwanda where the Clinton administration had not used the word genocide, Colin Powell getting out there being the first government in the world ever to say this situation is genocide whilst the violence was ongoing, it looked from the outside like this was a historical moment and a decision by the U.S. government as a whole that they were going to really do something. Go inside the policy black box, and it comes down to a judgment call made by Powell and Powell alone. His legal advisor told him literally, you can argue it one way or you can argue it the other. And it was a judgment call for him to make. He didn't consult with anybody else, and he advised President Bush 2 days before he made the public determination, by the way, on Thursday, I'm going to call this situation genocide, to which Bush said to Condi, you better let the other principals know so they're not surprised. So a very different perspective, depending on whether you're inside or outside the policy process, and just generally useful to have that information if we're trying to evaluate what impact advocacy is having. So in a situation that is largely a failure story, I want to highlight a few positive points at the outset. One is that in terms of funding, it's very hard to argue that the Save Darfur movement didn't have an enormous positive impact. Darfur funding was second only to Iraq and Afghanistan, and a good tenfold above every other crisis in Africa over a period from 2005 to 2008. You put those numbers and you couple them with what you hear from policymakers when you ask them, and they are consistently to this day amazed at how they would say to the Save Darfur people, I need to get X amount out of appropriations, and Save Darfur or one of the advocates associated with the movement would consistently come back with double that amount. So they had a huge impact on the amount of funding that went to aid, and that in turn had an impact on lives saved. When you have a situation where so many millions of people are stranded in displaced camps and dependent on humanitarian aid, ensuring that funding flows does mean ensuring that lives are saved. And Save Darfur has been critiqued a lot for having spent so much of its budget on public advertising rather than donating that money directly to the humanitarian organizations on the ground. One, I think, important fact to add into this conversation about the amount that they spent on public advertising is that they had an anonymous donor who made it a condition of the tens of millions that they were donating to Save Darfur that they spent that money on public advertising within quite a short period of time. And so it wasn't so much that Save Darfur was choosing to spend three-quarters of its budget on billboards and subways in New York as it wouldn't have had three-quarters of its budget were it not doing that. I think there are real questions for me as to whether it was a good decision to accept that anonymous donation. But it's a fact that they haven't managed to get out into the public realm yet. And regardless, to some extent, that public messaging did translate because the media continued to pay attention to the story and people in government continued to pay attention, particularly the members of Congress who continued appropriating these funds. So funding, a big check. Another check that I think has been a relief probably to people in the human rights community is that there is a constituency out there who can be motivated to care about these issues. People always said it until the Save Darfur movement tried it. It wasn't really known whether it could be true. But regular citizens who were not already signed up to a Human Rights Watch listserv could be convinced to take actions about a place that they have never been to and probably will never go to. I think there's someone on this panel who can speak more directly to it, but certainly in a number of interviews I've done with refugees and with those who are displaced, there's some benefit just to be signalling, yes, there are people who care about what is happening to you. And finally, perhaps the biggest benefit of this grand experiment in citizen activism was, for me, it has removed what was an alibi of US policymakers for much too long, which was, we could have fixed this if only the American public had created an outcry and pushed us to. And Save Darfur overwhelmingly removed that alibi and showed that there are many other pieces that need to be in place for us to deal with these sorts of crises. And that this sort of trope of, if only there was more political will, it doesn't really advance the conversation very far. It's not a success story, and my publisher very much wishes that it was, but in essence what we're talking about is a failure story. And today none of the causes or the effects of the violence have been resolved. The people who are in camps cannot return to their homelands. It's not secure enough for them to do so. 300,000 approximately lives have been lost. There's been no compensation. The people who perpetrated the crimes are in a even more powerful position than they were today, thanks to much of the world, spearheaded by the US government, supporting illegitimate so-called democratic elections last year. You have the man who's the most notorious leader of the Janjaweed of the 2003-2004 atrocities now representing North Darfur in parliament in Khartoum. So in terms of ultimate outcomes on the ground, this is not a success story. But it does give us, and I think advance our understanding both about how the policy process is made, and I'll deflect some of that to my other panelists, but just to highlight a few points about what it tells us or advances our understanding in terms of how you build political will. I think there was an assumption at the outset that political will is a good, more of it is better, and however you can come up with it is great. What I think we've learned from this process is that political will created by a mass movement has certain dynamics, and those certain dynamics bring with them real risks. One of the dynamics is that to build a mass constituency, you, by definition, need to reach out to people who are not already experts in your subject. That seems like pretty straightforward and obvious. That means that you have to some extent, simplify the story that you're telling in order to get them in. That, again, I think if you want to do a mass movement, you have to accept that that is just the reality of the beast that you're dealing with. What I certainly learn in the process is that's not the only problem. The problem is that once you recruit a whole bunch of people based on a simplified narrative, it becomes very, very difficult to update that narrative as the conflict changes over time. And even to the extent that you had leaders within the mass movement community aware that the conflict on the ground in Darfur was changing, they really struggled to update that with their constituents who were fitting in Darfur advocacy around everything else that they were doing in their lives and didn't have time to read detailed policy papers about what was happening. That's number one. Number two is that you cannot sustain a mass movement on failure alone. And, you know, you have someone who has picked up the kids late from school and has missed a work deadline because they've been doing their advocacy for Darfur. And at the end of the day, do you say to them, everything that you've done today has made absolutely no difference on the ground? You don't have a movement if you do that. But for long periods of the Darfur policy process, that was true. That was exactly the reality. By the time that Darfur advocacy really started kicking in, the US government, which was their target, had so little leverage over Khartoum, and it's a fact that, the US advocacy community is still pretty unwilling to admit. But sanctions had been in place, diplomatic and economic sanctions, from the 1990s, back when Sudan had hosted Osama bin Laden. So sanctions had already been maxed out. And then after the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, the other pressure that you could have had, the credible stick of saying, don't change this behavior and we will actually move in with force, that was gone as well. In addition, you had lost any sort of soft power leverage of we're going to go out and speak about human rights as the US and it's going to shame you. In fact, the US going out and speaking about human rights just made Khartoum go, great, thanks very much, public relations victory. We're going to point to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And so what you had left in terms of leverage was at best a few carrots saying, well, if you do this, then we will normalize our relations with you. And for the period that, we're talking about, and I think this changes now as South Sudan splits and potentially Khartoum becomes more vulnerable economically because it's losing oil revenue. But in the period we're talking about, Khartoum could kind of take or leave the carrots. It had strong support from China. It was getting good loans from Arab League countries. And so U.S. power to influence the situation was actually quite limited. But that's a hard pitch to sustain a movement on. And so what you got was advocacy leaders delivering quick wins. So success in your advocacy became, you know, how many emails can you send to the Assistant Secretary of State today? The other one, more substantive but in many ways no less problematic, was if we can get a special envoy appointed on Sudan, that will show that the US government is really treating this seriously and that we can improve the situation on the ground. And so year after year, advocates demanded that a special envoy be appointed. And year after year, the US government was only too happy to say, we did it. Look, we're listening to your concerns. We've appointed an envoy. But that was, again, when you go inside the policy system, creating a whole lot of fractures within the bureaucracy that was sending mixed messages to Khartoum and was ultimately not very effective in advancing the situation on the ground. But here, just to problematize this idea that more of an outcry is necessarily good and that political will can necessarily translate to achievements on the ground. All of that said, ultimately, I do not come out with a position that we should abandon a mass movement approach. I think that it wasn't done smart enough this time, and that's because it was the first time. I think there are situations where it could be useful, but I think it's only one way of building political will, and that we need to be careful in which situations we pick to sort of deploy this screaming outcry. And with that, I will hand over to back to Jerry.
Dr. Mohammed.
Thank you. When we want to discuss the problem of Darfur, as Beck discussed in her book, I think there are basic fundamentals we have to list them. affairs, is there a possibility for peace in Darfur? Then the next question will be, is the environment suitable for peace in Darfur now or not? Then we will go later to what will be the role of justice, and many others may ask, what's the cause of this genocide? But to me, being in the ground, I will just concentrate on the prospect for peace in Darfur. When in this occasion, I will congratulate my friends in South Sudan, because the referendum was very positive, and this was, we have been working as a group in South Sudan and Darfur as one group. And now we are really happy, because now that is the end result. It's a very fruitful. The second thing, what are the possibilities for peace in Darfur? For me, to discuss this, I should put four pointers. What's the situation in the ground? And then what's the situation of the rebel factions and the civil society, and the role of the United Nations and peacekeepers and the international players? And then the solution of government, right? Domestication of peace in Darfur. So situation in the ground, it had never improved. Let me put it very clear. Now people are dying because of lack of food, lack of health services, lack of water, and direct attack and assault by the Janjaweed, who are now a part of the government and determining the fate of Darfur. So this is the reality which we need to face when we are putting any plan for peace in Darfur. The second problem of the rebels, are they really in a situation to bring peace to Darfur or not? Good enough, because the last, everybody was really happy because the United States and the international community was voicing Darfur as a first priority. But at the end of the day, they realized that this is just a talk. And then they have a real work to do there themselves. So instead of dismantling into different groups and chattering into different groups, then now they are coming together. Last information is yesterday, where more than 20 or 20-something of the rebel factions are now in Doha, this is a stage for the peace. And I think this is a good one, because the information I had is that they are trying to find a momentum or a common ground for unification, or at least to reunite their visions on methods of peace in Darfur. So that is one, that's a positive thing. The positive thing is that the Darfur civil society, especially those in the displaced camps and in the refugee camps, they are determined. And the last survey Beck did in Eastern Chad, 98% of these survivors show that the justice is priority before peace. Because this is the reality. Because if somebody who is responsible for the peace in Darfur is a Janjaweed, and they are represented in all the leaders, the governors, the assistant for the president, they are the Janjaweed leaders. So how can this be? The only thing for them is to be justice, and then after that they can see, they can face the peace which will come. But if there is peace without justice, then nothing will be happening. And we know the role of Sudan government, it never abides by its commitments. So that is the position of the civil society and the refugees and the other groups. Then the role of the United Nations and African Union and the mediators, the vision of the people of Darfur on peacekeepers is just waste of money. They are not getting any benefit from that. This is put it clear. Because they are under the control of the government. They can't move to the stage where there is a war or there is help for the civilians. So this is what they feel. And the only thing is that they are the civil war, although they are very tired, they don't have a food, they don't have anything, and their women are targeted, their men are killed daily, but still they are determined because they have nothing to lose. This is the situation of the people on the ground. They have nothing to lose. So they have to fight for their freedom. And that is the situation. And they don't depend much about the peacekeeping missions. The African Union, it is double standards. The violation in Darfur are unprecedented. What we have seen in Rwanda, and we have seen in other countries, this was for a short while. But in Darfur, this is the eighth year, and the violation is continuous. And nobody is talking anything. And they are supporting the president. So that's the African Union is backing the president, who is the genocide indicted there. The other mediators, I think, let me put the United States, the role of the United States, the United Kingdom, the France, and the other countries. These are one group and one block, and they are working positively, while the Russia and China are supporting the government. So, different messages. Then the domestication of solution in Darfur. People are perceiving that this is just a continuation of the genocide itself, because the humanitarian workers are prevented from doing their normal work, their movement are restricted, their licenses are delayed, and there are a lot of problems. And even now they can't put the researches for follow-up and for the international community to know what is happening in the ground. I remember when we have been in the ground, we have been reporting everything to the international community and to the people of Sudan. But now everybody is skeptical, to even those humanitarian leaders of United Nations are skeptical to put this into stage and let the people know what's really running on and what are the shortcomings. So I think, yes, there's a positive optimism that the people of Darfur, they are optimistic about the peace, whether by war or through negotiations. And I will leave this for anybody who wants to ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mohammed. Good timing. Jahan, please.
Okay, so I work with Human Rights Watch as the Sudan researcher, and the height of the Darfur conflict was before my time. I was actually in Darfur in sort of mid-2006 and 2007, and then came here to work with Human Rights Watch on Sudan. So a lot of this, as Beck mentioned, a lot of the sort of the mass movement and the interest in Darfur actually preceded my time here. But I was aware of it, intensely aware of it, when I was actually on the ground in Darfur. And certainly the ICC was also in the news at that time, and we were all very aware of being in headlines. But things have changed and not changed. The situation on the ground, as the doctor was just describing, in Darfur is actually worse than it has been in a long time. It's more like what I experienced when I initially went there. where you have past patterns of conflict resurfacing. The Darfur Peace Agreement, which was brokered in 2006, was signed by one rebel movement, actually more than one, but the main one that signed it was Mini Menawi, and he's formally backed out of that now. So the Darfur Peace Agreement, which we all knew was dead for a long time, has been formally declared dead and gone. So that means that they can all start fighting afresh, and meanwhile, the peace process at Doha has foundered completely, and the rebels do, even though there are some signs of interest in reunification, they are not really united yet, not sufficiently united to have any leverage. So the situation on the ground is renewed fighting, and with it comes an element of ethnic targeting, because Mini Menawi happens to come from the Zarawa ethnicity, and as a result, the government, as they did throughout the Darfur conflict, end up targeting Zarawa towns and areas, and civilians do die in this tactic of war, which is a very primitive kind of warfare. It's not, you know, using anything more than rolling bombs off of Antonov airplanes, just as we've described for years. As far as we know, that's still the way that it's happening on the ground. And soldiers are still coming up in their technicals, their 4x4s, and with their militia, who are still riding horses and camels. These dynamics have not fundamentally changed from the information that we're getting from the ground. And it is alarming and saddening to me, having worked there at a time when we thought the DPA would bring some measure of peace. It hasn't. And nearly 5 years later, I'm seeing the same thing unfold on the ground. The IDPs are still in IDP camps. Those who decide to return to their villages often lead a lifestyle that's cyclical, where they spend a few days in the village and then run back to camp, spend a few days in camp, then run back to the village. Or, you know, they have several wives, one in the village, one in the, you know, so they try to make ends meet, leading their lives in both places so that they can till the fields and cultivate their fields. But the reality, it's not normal life. It's not at all the way they remembered it. So it is a depressing story, fundamentally, I have to say. But the fact that it has seems to have, you know, reverted back to what we saw before, I think, shows a need to keep working on it, a need to keep Darfur in the headlines. And, you know, the news about, I mean, the whole issue of impunity for these crimes, the fact that the government continues to perpetrate them and there seem to be no steps in the direction of justice. And this became all too clear over the past year when a committee headed by former President Thabo Mbeki released a report providing, you know, very good recommendations for how the Sudanese government could forge peace and promote justice in Darfur. And the AU backed it. The international community endorsed it. Everybody was very pleased, and we were waving this thing around for months saying, look at this incredible document. But the Sudanese government hasn't been pressed to do anything on it, and it's fallen off the policy radar. The U.S. government never mentions it. The AU doesn't mention it, even though it's essentially its own creation. And instead, we see the AU talking about deferring the ICC. We see France talking about offering a deferral. We see these justice initiatives that were part and parcel with the solutions for Darfur have now also slipped off the radar and started to move backwards. So as we were hearing before, the people of Darfur, either in the diaspora or on the ground, for them justice is incredibly important, and it's always a topic of conversation. So how do we keep justice on the radar, and how do we keep Darfur on the agenda? And I think you know, all of the things that I've just said are very depressing, and it can be a real cynical story. But I think one of the challenges now would be to figure out how to re-articulate the whole thing, especially given the secession of the South. So the media headlines have been stolen by the referendum completely over the past, I'd say, year, because first it was the elections, then it was the referendum. people aren't really reporting on Darfur. Journalists haven't had access to Darfur. But what people need to understand now, I think, is how Khartoum and the regime in Khartoum, the government, really is has a holistic, we used to call it the all-Sudan policy, we can now call it the all-North Sudan policy, I think, because there is a pattern in Sudan. It's not just Darfur, there's also trouble brewing in other peripheral areas and areas where you have marginalized people who have similar grievances in eastern Sudan and southern Kordofan and Blue Nile and in Darfur. And there are some people in Sudan who are already talking about sort of a belt encircling the center of sort of problem areas that Khartoum has to deal with. And I think it's very important, I think, to kind of shift the narrative forward. As Beck was mentioning, the narrative needs to change over time. It's not the same story. There's still the same facts on the ground, but we do need to find ways to talk about it realistically, and I think bring international pressure to bear on those responsible in drawing, sort of connecting the dots more, and doing a better job of that. I don't know if, you know, mass movement is the answer, and I think that some of what Beck was just describing it certainly rings true for us. I mean, we've seen how the big profile or the sort of the high profile aspect of the Darfur problem has been both positive and negative, and sometimes it's difficult to analyze where the impact has been successful and where it hasn't. But the challenge would be to still find ways to re-articulate this problem and to keep it on the agenda. And I think I just close with that question, whether or not, you know, the toolkit should include mass movement the way that it has in the past, or if that moment is now past and we're looking at maybe some other tools that we need to keep using on the Sudan story. And also not forgetting that mass movement within Sudan is actually where the answer lies. And, you know, people in Sudan who were protesting just last week in Khartoum will certainly tell you what happens when they try to do mass movements. And I think it's interesting that the opposition party members and leaders did not actually participate in the protests. And that's a telling detail about the state of politics inside Sudan itself. And that's also something we have to understand and pay attention to when we talk about doing advocacy on Sudan. Over to you.
Thank you, Jahan.
Yeah.
Yes, Fabian.
Hi, everyone. I'm Fabienne Hara. I'm very pleased to be here tonight. I met Rebecca 6 years ago at Harvard University. I was a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights, and she was a student. And at that time, she and her fellow students were creating the movement. So it was actually really fascinating to watch them, the students, as well as Samantha Power and others, really create this movement from scratch. It has come a long way since then, and I, you know, would like to start by saying congratulations for, you know, taking on this this task of trying to assess the impact of the movement. I think it's quite brave to ask the right questions and not to fall into, you know, this sort of self-congratulatory mode that, you know, all the NGOs at some point fall into, including mine. So congratulations on that. I think the book asks a lot of good questions. I'll come back to some of your comments now. I was also in Sudan while the Save Darfur movement was very active. I was the head of political affairs in the UN peacekeeping mission in Sudan, so based in Khartoum, during the Darfur crisis and also during the peace process in Abuja. And we actually supported that peace process. So, I mean, my observations will be based on my my impressions at the time working for the UN and working from Sudan, but also based on my current experience and my current job at the International Crisis Group, which, as you know, is also an organization that tries to ring alarm bells when conflict erupts. That was also created after the Rwandan genocide, the crisis in Bosnia, and in Somalia. And both, I think, both the Save Darfur movement and the International Crisis Group reflect this changing landscape in peace and security where civil society is taking an increasing role Peace and security, as you know, has always been the monopoly of states, but increasingly there is now more private actors in this field. Now, just to come back to what Rebecca said at the very beginning, it seems to me that, of course, it's very, very difficult to differentiate the impact of Save Darfur and mass movements from the general failure of policy, of international policy. But it seems to me that the mass movement had unintended consequences. And I'll just list a few. While it is very true and very certain that the existence of the mass movement and the fact that the mass movement, the Darfur situation was in the international media really annoyed the government of Sudan. There's no question about that. And probably at a certain stage kept them on watch, perhaps helped reduce the level of violence on the ground. This is just a hypothesis here. It's also true that the movement contributed to oversimplify the crisis, and that slogans became almost a substitute for policy. And because this movement did not have people on the ground, they did not have field-based analysis, very quickly they started, the disconnect between the slogans and the reality on the ground started becoming very obvious to me. And I remember very vividly receiving reports from the Department of Security at the UN, reports on violence in Darfur, on the fragmentations of rebel groups, on the criminal violence, on the political violence between government and rebels, etc. And then looking at what I saw in the papers and saying, there's something wrong here. You know, tens of thousands of people die every day, are raped every day. That was the ad in the paper, put there by the movement, and the reports that I was getting, which offered a very violent picture of the situation, don't get me wrong, but a very different picture with a lot of different pieces to it. It was not so simple. As Jehan said, the conflict went through a lot of different forms. It has become very intractable now, but for many different reasons, and not only because there is violence coming from the government. There's more fragmentation now. I think the fragmentation is really an issue that is very difficult to resolve for any policymaker. Also, another observation that I had at the time was, This is supposed to be a human rights movement, or at least based on the human rights concerned, with a very moralistic approach. And they're calling for a very aggressive intervention in Sudan. Isn't there something wrong with a human rights movement calling for war? Because this is exactly what would have happened in the end of the day. The government of Sudan clearly said, we will oppose any international intervention, particularly an aggressive one. So we were all actually struggling with this. What would a military intervention make a difference? And they said, Khartoum said very clearly, we'll call for jihad if there is an international intervention. So anyway, it was complicated. Then another one that I thought was quite problematic, but this is not only, doesn't only apply to Save Darfur, it applies to a lot of international policymakers, was the glamorization of rebel leaders. The rebel leaders were pictured, described, portrayed as freedom fighters. And quite frankly, if you see the record they have on leadership, the refusal, constant refusal to come to the negotiation table, basically which means that the IDPs stay in camp, which means that these people also have a very, very, very small chance of going home at this point. If you see, the Abdel Wahid of the, I'm sorry to pick on one person in particular, but Abdel Wahid remote controlling resistance to genocide from Paris, there's something wrong with the picture here also. Bit of that is that they started portraying themselves as victims. They thought the international community would do the work for them and they would arrive in Khartoum, based on, on French tanks or something like that. It obviously was not going to happen. So the responsibility of the leadership also, of, representing the victims, I think, has been neglected in a way. Then another intended consequence, and again, this is not necessarily the only exclusive responsibility of the mass movement, But another unintended consequences was that there was too much focus on Darfur and not enough focus on the CPA at the time. We kept reporting on the CPA and on the need for good offices, for mediation, for political capital to be spent on making unity attractive, on political and democratic reforms in particular, democratic transformation, two very important objectives of the CPA, and there was absolutely no response because everyone in New York and elsewhere, in all capital cities, were obsessed by Darfur, and not only obsessed by Darfur, but obsessed by peacekeeping in Darfur. And in the end, that sort of created a sense of emergency that led to a series of very bad deals. We had no attention on the CPA. We had a very bad deal with the DPA in Darfur that was forced down the throat of the movement, and only one signed in the end. It was abandoned almost immediately. We had a bad peacekeeping deal in Darfur with a hybrid mission that struggled to take off. Took off in 2008, 5 years after the major peaks of violence. I mean, this is not exactly a response to a very urgent situation of violence. A very bad deal with Chad, MINURCAT, the UN peacekeeping force, was born out of an aborted project of doing something for the IDPs and the refugees of Darfur without any political plan, any exit strategy or anything like that. It led also to the International Committee generally and the UN also to lose contact with the NCP. Completely. We lost access to them for months. Our DSRSG of the mission was expelled. And it also led to a justice process, leading, as you know, to the indictment of President Bashir that, frankly, could have been handled differently. We can come back to that. But I'm not sure that the ICC indictment today is doing justice to the victims of Darfur. I don't think that some of the victims of Darfur would say this is justice for them. It's not enough, anyway. So, of course, the force that was set up to intervene in Darfur to stop the violence, the Security Council that set up this force, did not go all the way. They stopped short of endorsing an enforcement force, a Chapter 7 enforcement mission, because they didn't want to not to do it without the consent of the government of Sudan. And China got a lot of blame for stopping or slowing down the process, but the reality is that nobody, not one member of the Security Council, was ready to go all the way and fight the government of Sudan on this. So again, bad deal on peacekeeping, I think. The fundamental miscalculation, and I'll conclude very soon after that, the fundamental miscalculation of policymakers, of the mass movement, I think, is that they did not realize that the CPA was more important than Darfur. And I'll say that very bluntly. And it's particularly true for this country, for the US. The North-South process ended 50 years of war. There was a lot of investment in southern Sudan, a lot of help to the SPLM, a lot of political investment had been made in this deal. It was part of a containment strategy of northern Sudan. This was the most important thing, I think. So you had the logic of engagement that was necessary, especially with the North, with the NCP, fighting the logic of punishment and pressure in Darfur. It could not work. It simply could not work. One was always put against the other and balanced against the other. So the logic of pressure and so on in the case of Darfur could not go all the way for that reason. In a way, the CPA was a protection for the NCP. And I'll just end with one comment on genocide in general. To prevent genocide, we have to understand genocide. There are many things, I think, that there's a lot of homework that needs to be done. There is a difference between instrumentalist violence and essentialist violence. There's a difference between genocidal acts, genocidal campaign, genocidal conflict, genocidal regime. And then when you look at the history, a lot of the genocide or genocidal campaigns have not ended with external interventions. So I think there's a need to study the dynamics of the conflicts or the genocides that we are trying to, end. And this applies also to my own organization. It's very difficult to just be against genocide. Genocide doesn't come by, very often. And by the way, if the commitment is to prevent genocide, then we should all of us have been there last year talking about Sri Lanka. You know, when the government bombed the Tamil people on this beach in Sri Lanka, 30,000 people died in a couple of months. There was no real outcry. In Eastern Congo right now, there are genocidal acts being committed, not necessarily by the ones who committed genocide in Rwanda. There's not a lot of discussion about these crimes. So the Darfur movement is not necessarily transferable. So if I think for the future, this is something that needs to be worked on. You know, a lot of situations demand attention, and movements have to be able to be consistent and not apply double standards, pick one situation and not work on others. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Fabian. Well, I think we've had some very thought-provoking commentary. So we've got time, plenty of time actually, for questions. And as Steve said at the beginning, we're recording this for a podcast, so we need you to speak into a microphone. And there's a microphone in the middle, so you can go there to ask a question. And I think while people are gathering themselves to ask a question, I would start. What did you?
I was keen to just respond to a couple of things.
I was going to ask you to, so.
Okay, here we go. That's easy.
Mind meld.
We are broadly on the same page, but a couple of things. This idea that slogans are not policy. Well, obviously they shouldn't be. I don't think you can say that is the fault of a movement. A movement is supposed to come up with slogans, and the policy process is supposed to come up with policy, and it's laziness on the side of the policymakers to substitute the slogans for the policy. There's one memo that I got given that was from the special envoy in Sudan to, he was at that point Deputy Secretary of State, saying, you know, there's a disjunct between what advocates are demanding and what is needed to resolve the situation, but it's politically risky to challenge the advocacy narrative, basically. Well, that is your job. Take on that political risk. That is your job as the policymaker. If you have better information than the advocates have got, then it's your responsibility to go with the accurate information. So I'm just pushing back a little bit against this idea that necessarily becomes the advocate's fault. And regarding the CPA, I think, again, I'm in broad agreement. But if you go inside the advocacy movement, it's a black box, much like the policy process was. And if you go inside the advocacy movement, there were fights between leaders of the advocacy movement over how much attention to pay to Darfur versus this comprehensive peace agreement that was dealing with all of Sudan. And even once, and Jerry, you can probably speak to it more, but even once there was some recognition that more attention needed to be on the whole of Sudan picture, it just became very difficult to communicate that message out to the mass constituency, which is back to this issue of it's a problem when you get them in on one narrative of a conflict and find that you can't change. But from inside the policy process, it was more difficult to do these things than in hindsight we say obviously should have been done.
So I encourage you to step to the microphone. Are you ready? You have a question? Yeah.
Hi. My name is Akwesi Edu. I'm based in Senegal. I work at Trust Africa, which is an African grant-making foundation based in Senegal. I'm struggling with something, and I don't know how to pose it as a question, so I'll make a comment of it. And that is that ultimately, power concedes nothing without demand. And the mass movement is really key, notwithstanding the contradictions and the limitations that such a movement would have. And in Africa, the biggest issue, challenge we're facing on Darfur is how to really build a movement across the continent, especially in countries that have the high moral ground. I mean, obviously, if you are in Zimbabwe, your most immediate concern is how to get rid of Mugabe, perhaps. And so Darfur is not really number one on your radar. But if you're in Ghana or Senegal, and yet we know that in many parts of Africa, that traction hasn't yet occurred. The way we saw it, for example, with the anti-apartheid struggle. And so I suppose my struggle is, you know, even if the mass movement has all these challenges and limitations and so on, I'm not sure, and this is mostly in response to your point, which I think is a very interesting point, but what's in place of a mass movement? I mean, ultimately, we want the government to be held accountable. We want governments, especially governments that have leverage, to take action. And we want as many people as possible to make this an issue. The other point, I suppose, is that perhaps Darfur is closer to the anti-apartheid struggle than it is maybe to the situation we saw in 94 in Rwanda, or even Burundi, and you know, even in Zimbabwe, the Matabeleland massacres. In a sense that there might well be, and this is in response to your point, there might well be a liberation struggle element to it. And part of, you know, building a movement like that is that it's going to be very controversial. And, you know, those of us who know what happened in South Africa, the anti-apartheid movement was full of all these contradictions you've talked about. You know, so I don't want to, you know, go on and on and on, but I suppose I'm making a pitch for doing more of it. And obviously it should be done better than before, but I wouldn't really jettison it or make it look like it's a problem.
Thank you. I guess another way of framing that framing it as a question is, would people in Darfur be better off if this movement hadn't existed, in spite of unintended consequences?
I can't answer that definitively, but what I can say is that the argument is certainly not for abandoning the mass movement. It's to do it smarter, more sophisticated, and absolutely more global. I mean, I think one of the key problems here is that you had all this energy focused almost entirely on the U.S. government, who just wasn't the best positioned. Now, had you had a real sort of people's movement pressuring the AU in addition, then I think you would have had vastly different dynamic than what you've got today. So as much as, you know, and this is always the risk when you start highlighting problems, is you come across as saying, you know, this is all wrong, give up on it. That is not the argument, but it's saying that there have been really big problems with how it's been done so far and that the expectations haven't matched the reality.
Yeah, I think that's also a pitch. Let me just add there. I think that's also a pitch for, as I think we were both saying, better understanding the dynamics and better contextualizing what's happening in the country. Sudan is in a different place right now than it was 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and understanding the government and what it's doing and how it's, why the parallels to apartheid are actually quite relevant. Exactly how does that work? Rather than just having the word genocide be taken, you know, as a brand name, doesn't make sense to people. So I think that's, in a way, a good pitch for...
Suleiman.
Beck, you sounded a bit sad that the book is ending on a failure note or a negative note. But this is a situation on the ground, and this is the very recent past. What will happen next in the coming few months and years, and we are seeing signs of that right now, is why it's very relevant that we build from this perspective of what happened with the movement to reinvent it, minus all the negatives, the unintended consequences that we were underlined here. There is going to be very much a real need for a mass movement to prevent, you know, multiple Darfurs in Sudan. And this is what I see and predict as going to happen in post-independence of South Sudan in the remaining part of the country. It's true, you know, what's happening is Darfur is affecting the new south of what remains of Sudan. It's affecting the southern Blue Nile, it's affecting the Nuba Mountains. It's this idea of the marginalized, the abandoned masses, you know, encircling the center, which has the privilege of monopoly of power and wealth in the country. So what if this regime is so evil that in provision for that, it's tolerating the population of the displaced in Darfur, 2.7 million in IDP camps, because of, you know, a deliberate design of demographic engineering? What if its idea of, you know, the useful triangle in Sudan, the Musallas Hamdi, where most of the oil money was invested in infrastructure, in bridges, in opening new farming land, was precisely a strategy looking at this future and trying to provide for a population constituency base that would prevent, you know, the uprising of these abandoned and marginalized masses. The project of the current regime in Sudan, which is one of Islamization, Arabicization of the country, and Bashir has said it, and his ministers have said it since the referendum of South Sudan over the last few months, of a country where Islam is the official religion and Arabic the official language, is definitely condemning the country to more, you know, of campaigns of killing, more of mass atrocities, and more of mass violations. And believe me, the regime is very well equipped of that, with, you know, for that. So the idea is not this is the past. You know, things happened that were negative, and we ended up with failure. Escalation is what is happening now in Darfur. New displacement is happening at this time as we speak. And this is just the beginning. I foresee a convergence of armed insurgencies from Darfur, southern Blue Nile, and Nuba Mountains. Again, it's this Islamization, Arabicization project. None of this population want to be independent. None of them want to have self-autonomy. But they want their difference to be acknowledged, diversity to be recognized in the institutions of the land. They want to practice their Islam the way they have always done, just like in the rest of Africa, in Senegal, or Mali, or Niger. They want their culture, which is more closer to the brethren in South Sudan, to be acknowledged. And in fact, they have fought in the Nuba Mountains and southern Blue Nile the war on the side of the SPLM. They are the SPLM in today's Sudan. So what are we talking about? It's not Darfur. It's the entire country. And you need a movement which is retooled to deal with a much larger disaster than what we ever witnessed up to now. That's what I see. Thanks.
Isn't exactly a question, but is there any reply?
Don't look at what do you suggest for how to move this forward?
Oh, he's asked, what do you suggest for how to move this forward?
Well, I think it is this issue to put the positive spin on it. This issue that this conflict, this situation is evolving over time is very true. And with the South leaving, it does change the position for Khartoum. And I think the economy is something that has enabled them to maintain a level of support within the North that is now certainly under risk. And I think you're right that you're going to be having more pushing from the periphery as the battle shapes up over what will be this new northern nation, because it's not just a new south, it's also a new north. And so the points of leverage, you know, this analysis is going to be out of date soon too, in terms of the US government had the least amount of leverage over Khartoum. That leverage is going to be changing as Khartoum needs normalization more, because it's not going to be able to cope with taking on the level of debt that it's acquired and everything else. So part of the call is to continually update what are the points of leverage, and to move the model beyond thinking that it's just about the US. And, you know, imagine a mass movement that is pushing the African Union, and it's not going to look the same as a mass movement looks like in the US. It's going to have different dynamics, and efforts that US advocates made to try to go global, and they did see this and try to deal with it at one point, they just weren't terribly sophisticated in the approach that they took, but I think there's room there to do better. But in addition, working out how there are some things that a mass movement is good at doing, but there are some things that are not, that it's not good at doing, and that's okay. There are other actors within the political system, your so-called grass tops or your policy entrepreneurs who can take on those different roles, and they need to be activated and brought to the table more as well, rather than just assuming, you know, if the public outcries, then things will happen.
Yeah, my name is Abdullahi, and I'm Kenyan. I just came to the United States 2 years ago, and one of the first things that fascinated me was the level of adverts with respect to Darfur. And it was something that I was, I come from Kenya, but it's closer to Sudan. And I was surprised by the level of, you know, media presence of Darfur. And when I asked around, everybody in campus was interested in Darfur movement. And I was like, well, there must be something that I don't know that these guys know. But one observation that everybody makes with regard to the, you know, Darfur movement or any other movement that, you know, stops, that is trying to stop genocide, is the Rwanda question. It's closer to Rwanda, I think, in terms of scale and even, you know, the number of people who are dying in DRC is higher. So I wondered why it was very easy for the Darfur question to be framed the way it was. Was it a question of, was very easy to frame because was the, you know, Muslims, Arabs against the blacks who are savages. Why was it very easy in terms of framing? Even as somebody who's practiced journalism in Nairobi, it beats me why it's very easy, the Darfur question can be framed very easily, and everybody buys into it. Whereas DRC Congo is complex, rich, and nuanced, so nobody wants to deal with it. So I probably would want your input with regard to that. Because if you look at the number of people who have died in DRC, I'm not saying that fewer people died, so let's not pay attention to it. But I'm saying even in terms of scale, in DRC, the number of people who have died is a lot higher. I'm saying why is there that disconnect? The other question is what O'Hara raised, the observation that she made with regard to with regard to numbers. He said that the number of people who are dying even now is higher. So when it comes to genocide, one of the biggest things that, you know, we look into aside from intent is the number of people who are killed. But the number of people who are killed, you mentioned that the numbers that you guys were getting and the numbers that were reported were completely different. At the same time, all was blamed on the government of Sudan. But there were other, you know, secondary causes of death. If you look at WHO, has got completely different, you know, data with regard to the number of people who have died. And I think they're mentioning that it plateaued at some point, the point at which the Darfur, you know, movement was putting a lot of pressure and using the number. These are the number of people who have died. So I think that is the other question that I find a little bit difficult to wrestle with. The number of people who have actually died, from data from World Health Organization, people have got people on the ground, and from the movement, like Darfur movement. And finally, it was about Darfur movement was essentially meant to be a peace movement. So for them to say out of Iraq into Sudan, I found, was the observation that you made, I find it very difficult. And one of my professors said, Darfur is charity, whereas, you know, in Iraq is taxes, and Americans do not really like taxes. So it's very easy for them to, you know, say charity. Yeah, let's think about Darfur and not think about, you know, Iraq, where more people are dying too. And those were my questions.
We can, go in order.
The definition of there is a variation in the definition of genocide, and I think I was there before, and the intent we were there. If anybody reads the intention, which was from 1978, and it is a written document, and it is there, and it's proceeding on, and the intention of the government making the perpetrators in their privileged positions, and neglecting the justice for the survivors. That's one thing. The other thing is that the government still is preventing even the humanitarian work. And that means there are many people are killed due to, not just because they are killed through the war, direct war, but it's due to disease, malnutrition, and infections, and other things. And still, I know the number of people who died in Darfur is more than 500,000 population than what is written in the documents. That's not true, because I was there, and I know what's happening daily. And the people who are now documenting, none of them had gone to Darfur inside during the war and have witnessed what the catastrophe is going on. That is one of the problems. The policy of the government is to prevent anybody to assess what was really going on. So I think that's a problem. And it is the people are trying to prevent what happened in South Sudan, where more than 2 million people are killed, and this is now unfolding in front of them. So this is the right and the obligation for the international community to protect the civilians and not the fighters. It's the role of the international community to protect the civilians. So I think that's a problem. I know what's happening in Congo, but it is a matter of there are the means of killing in Congo is different from what is happening in Sudan. And this is why the people have their own justifications for assessing the problem.
On your first question, why is Darfur, the Darfur crisis, easier to frame? I mean, Darfur, the movement, mass movement on Darfur, benefited from a lot of different previous movements. I mean, there was the Black Caucus that supported anti-slavery in Sudan, the Christian right in this country, that might also explain why, you know, the religious aspect of the conflict was portrayed in a very simplistic way, you know, the Arab Muslims against the African Christians. And there was also, in addition to that, a student movement, Hollywood celebrities, etc. I think it was an unbeatable combination, really. And maybe also it made the movement quite unique, and it might not make it very transferable to other situations as well. And then in terms of numbers, I mean, I really don't know how many people have died of direct violence in Darfur. I can tell you that within the UN, there was a big fight about numbers, between the various parts of the UN system. What I was trying to say earlier in my presentation was that the reports we were getting of the various peaks of violence, we were getting them on a weekly or monthly basis, did not add up to the ads that were in the paper. The ads in the paper were saying tens of thousands of people are dying every day. And it was simply not true, you know. So I understand why there was a need for slogans, but it was just not translating into my reality, our reality on the ground. Now, overall, I don't know how many people have died, probably hundreds of thousands of direct violence and maybe millions, I don't know, of indirect violence. It's going to be very difficult to know because it was... Lots of humanitarian organizations did not have access to pockets of territory inside Darfur, so this is not something I can answer.
Yeah, try to be quick on this connection or linking between Darfur and Rwanda. It's important to remember that Darfur was not on the headlines of any paper when the crisis was erupting in 2003. It was not getting a mention. The only reason that it started to pick up media attention was that in April of 2004, it was the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, and people started very consciously trying to draw a link as a way of getting it into the media, because the media could hook their coverage of the 10th anniversary commemorations of Rwanda, use that hook to start to get in something about Darfur. So that's how it came about. It wasn't sort of by magic. It was a conscious effort by people who were trying to raise attention to Darfur to get it into the public psyche. And in terms of that attention-grabbing tactic, it was very effective. Obviously, it had some serious detrimental consequences on subsequent events, but there's no mystery. That's why it happened. It's often troped out, sort of brought out that, you know, this Save Darfur wanted out of Iraq and into Darfur. It was never a policy position of any formal advocacy organization. I have never seen it myself, but I've seen a photo of a sign at the edge of a rally saying that, which evidently some member of the public believed. But I think we need to get away from the idea that this was a policy position that was endorsed by any of the advocacy organizations that we're scrutinizing. And then I'd also love to get away from this idea that genocide is about numbers. Mass atrocity can be about numbers. Numbers may be a good reason to decide to pay attention to something and not something else. But the legal definition of genocide, what it distinguishes it from other war crimes and crimes under international law, is this issue of intent. And numbers are only one small piece that can help you assess that question of intent.
I just wanted to add, I'm glad you brought up that the point about out of Iraq and into Sudan being a sign that was someplace. I mean, it was never, as far as I know, in the times that I was involved, and I was not involved with Save Darfur through this whole period, but I don't think that that was ever an organized call. And this professor has written this book where he acts as though that's what everyone, the drumbeat that everyone was making, and it's just simply fanciful. The other thing that I would just point out about this connection between the Rwanda anniversary and Darfur is I'm not sure, I don't think it would really be totally fair to say that there was an organized movement that was making that connection in April 2004, because it didn't exist.
Right, the movement didn't exist at all. The movement came about in part as a result of that, but it was specific strategic action by what we call policy entrepreneurs to draw those links.
Well, Kofi Annan drew the... I mean, he made a statement on the anniversary of the beginning of the genocide, and he said, and he made that connection, George Bush did, so... I mean, it was not as though there was some cabal of policy entrepreneurs or anyone who was drawing a link. I mean, it was public figures who were making that connection, and it seemed to resonate, obviously, as you say. Yes.
Hi. Thank you for the really thought-provoking, wonderful presentation. I was actually involved in the student movement at Georgetown, and so I'm really engaged and interested in the discussion. And I guess the one question that I feel I guess is most interesting to us going forward is that in order to achieve peace in Darfur, the coalition, the rebel movements coming together into a coalition to actually be able to go to the table and speak with the government is sort of an important step, and obviously was not successful in 2006. What do you think is needed in order to get the rebel movements together in order to put them in a strong negotiating position? And furthermore, does this sort of new referendum pose a moment of leverage of the rebel movement with the government of Sudan, or is it actually sort of detrimental because of the timing? So, thank you.
I want to point to Suleiman on the issue of rebel groups.
What's the possibility for them to unite and be effective in leverage with the government?
Well, I went to a workshop on justice issues for representative of one faction of what became the Liberation and Justice Movement. there were 230 leaders of this movement in one hotel hosted by the Qatari government in Doha. This is just one movement. Delegates from the other movements stayed in other hotels, and at one time when there were parallel negotiations with different rebel groups, representatives were by the dozens. The Doha process was, is unique from many aspects. I was in Doha in July when there was a meeting for civil society from Darfur. 480 representatives of civil society were brought, by specially chartered flights from Darfur. There is a deliberate strategy from Khartoum to splinter the rebel movements, but also to splinter civil society and to really prevent, actual coalitions of rebel factions to unify. But the realities on the ground are forcing a dynamic of reunification of the rebel movements. Why? Because as the South secedes and the entire attention of the international community is focused on the North-South dynamics of the Sudan, the government is getting away on what's happening in Darfur. And that has led to a campaign of bombing and of direct military expeditions against different factions on the ground, hence the escalation that Dr. Muhammad just described, the new displacement and so on. But rebel factions were forced to fight together to protect themselves and to give some relief to other groups that are coming under government attack. And this is what's forcing the unity. Any meaningful unity of rebel factions would have to come from the ground up. But the political leadership on the top, I believe, is totally compromised because of all this factionalism and the division. Doha became a laboratory for factions splintering into two and three and four, and you just lose count of how many of these groups there are. I think I'm not very optimistic there.
Leverage question, I think it's an interesting time because you have one dynamic of, I think, Khartoum potentially increased vulnerability because of the South seceding. Who knows exactly what the numbers will be on what oil revenue it gets, what a proportion of debt it gets. So that is potentially positive. On the downside, my concern is that the international community, and in particular the US, has used so much of whatever leverage it had to just get the southern referendum happening. That what is going to be left for the North is, I think, a real question right now.
And the need to congratulate al-Bashir for allowing a referendum. I mean, that.
This is part of, one of the big policy.
Yeah.
Right, one of the big policy. I've focused it today on the critiques of the mass movement, but the book also is pretty deeply critical of the policy process, and one of the major criticisms to be made is that it keeps buying into Khartoum's strategy of playing one part of the country off against another. And so we say, we'll give you X, Y, Z, the world, for progress on the South, and then Khartoum says, well, we delivered on the South, so are you going to stand up to your word and give us what you promised? Well, yes, because you need to be credible, to make future promises give you any leverage. On the other hand, what do you do about Darfur, which you've siphoned off into a different set of policy options?
To play devil's advocate, the from the U.S. perspective, they've given a very defined fillip for the referendum, and even have still conditioned it on resolving Abyei and the post-referendum arrangements, and there's still a number of things, debt relief, the whole body of sanctions, and whether they'll hold to that, who knows. But
right, and it's certainly, well, two things. One, that's not the way that Khartoum sees it or is playing it, as evidenced by when the foreign minister came 2 weeks ago and said, where's Darfur? But two, I mean, you can, yes, that's the stipulated policy, but in practice, when have you seen them in the past 6 months talk or speak or say or do anything, certainly in public and I think in private as well, on Darfur? If you put all your attention on one area, it doesn't matter if you say, well, actually, reward Z that you get to won't happen until you come to Darfur. You've already signaled that this is the area that you care about.
I just want to say that the situation in Sudan after the referendum and after the likely secession of the South, I mean the sure secession of the South now, has changed. I don't think we can look at it exactly the way we used to look at it, you know, a year ago, six years ago, etc. I mean, the country is going to split. Khartoum, however strong and evil this regime is going to lose a third of its territory. They are being blamed by a lot of people in northern Sudan for that. I don't think that Khartoum is as strong as and the NCP is as united as it was, you know, as we assume here in this conversation. I think things have changed quite fundamentally. I think Bashir could lose his job. And it will not be because of the international pressure, but because, you know, his own people, his own constituencies will blame him for the loss of the South, for failing at keeping unity of the country. This is what happened in Yugoslavia. I mean, it's not the it's not so much the international indictment that, you know, made Milosevic lose his job, but it's the loss of the war in Kosovo. So, I mean, I think that also needs to be factored in. There will be a lot of problems in the north. I agree with Suleiman's analysis. There will be a lot of problems in the south. But it's a very traumatic moment for both the north and the south to have to reconfigure themselves. I don't think it's going to be an easy process for anybody, including the elite in Khartoum.
We have time for one or two more questions.
Over the past, I guess, couple of years, like the Obama administration has taken a lot of positions on the Sudan that the activist community really hasn't been happy with. For instance, the appointment of Scott Gratian as Sudan envoy and his failure to be reassigned despite strong opposition within the administration, especially from Susan Rice. Also the fact that the administration is considering taking Sudan off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. I'm wondering if sort of these developments prove that really the Save Darfur movement is dead as sort of a movement that has any sort of political power or leverage whatsoever. And I'm wondering what your reaction to that would be. And also, do you see any possible benefits to the Obama administration's sort of more open policy towards towards the Bashir regime? Thanks.
I mean, the Bush administration did a bunch of things that advocates didn't like either. I don't think you can judge the success or failure of a movement based on that alone. And in terms of engagement with the Bashir regime, like I said, from the kind of just realistic analysis of what leverage they have, what else are they going to do? There are no other real policy options. Now that's going to start to change. But I think that the Obama administration going in probably took a look at what they had and worked out trying to use to work with what they had, and that was offering normalization. Does anyone want to?
I remember Scott Gratian, when he took the job, I was there in Washington in his first meeting with NGOs, and he said, you know, I looked around and I looked for leverage and I didn't find any. I mean, the only leverage that I identify is that I guess we could bomb somebody or something, but that's basically it, you know. So I think that's the only leverage that he defined, I think, was through engagement with the regime.
I think the United States government had plenty of potentials. One, the potential, the people of Darfur and Sudan, these are the biggest assets for the United States to campaign, because the people who are the ones who formulate the situation in the ground, and this is now you can see what's happening in Khartoum. In every town of North Sudan there is demonstration, and the people are now very clear, they know what are their rights. So that's the fairest asset for the United States to work with the civil society and the people of Darfur, of Sudan, as a group, not as a, as individuals. That's one thing. The second thing, there are plenty of international resolutions for Sudan. Why should they stop? Why shouldn't they implement them? That's a genuine question. If you don't have a leverage to implement, why did you issue them first? That's a fundamental question. And if you have the right to issue the resolution, then you have to be sure that they are implemented. And that's a real political way. And I know the United States has a leverage for the France and the European community and other guys. But I am sure that the homework was not done in Africa itself. That's a very clear thing. And that's one of the negative side of it. And I think, yeah, the Gresham, I don't want to talk what I did, but I know I met him many times. And we put directions for how South and North will be resolved. And that's a credit for him. People in from Darfur working with him, putting the basic fundamentals, how to solve it, that's an easy exercise. So they are he never invested in these assets, and that's one of the problems. Maybe I believe that the president now supported Gresham with other representatives from in South Sudan case and in Darfur case. There are others because I believe that this is due to weakness of Gresham himself. And if that's true, that means the United States have never built a real policy for Sudan how to resolve the conflicts in Sudan as a country and not as regions. That's what I believe.
Well, unfortunately, I think we're getting down to the end of the time that we've got because we do another couple. What?
One more question.
One more.
I'm Pamela Yates from Skylight Pictures. I would like to ask everyone, now that we're facing a new reality on the ground and two countries, what effect do you think the International Criminal Court arrest warrant against al-Bashir has? Because obviously the effects change as the country changes. And I'm talking about the effects apart from the actual arresting him and taking him to The Hague.
I think that if, as I said before, if Bashir loses his job, it will not be because of the ICC, it will be because of internal dynamics of the National Congress Party. I'm not sure that even his own people will hand him over to the ICC. It's likely that there will be at some point some restructuring and reorganization of the regime. They did that several times in the past, and you know they got rid, for example, of Hassan al-Turabi, who was the ideologue of the regime, very strong man. If they can do that to Turabi, they can do that to Bashir. And you know he's not irreplaceable. Now, would they hand him over to the ICC? I really doubt it. So I don't know. I really don't see this process going very fast. And in the meantime, I'll repeat what I said before. I think there are other forms of justice that need to be. For example, return of the IDPs or compensation for the IDPs. I mean, this one example among others, but there are many ways of doing justice. Indicting a head of state is not the only one.
I don't know what people are thinking, but people, the survivors, they put first that justice is number one. That is their right, and that is the role of the international community to implement this. And this can be through the peace mechanism. But the one glimmer I can see is that South Sudan, the first day the issue of the referendum results, they said, we are going to join ICC. So that means the circle is getting narrower and so and you see what happened in the East Africa, Kenya, Uganda, Central Africa, and even now he's not in good terms with his friend Gaddafi. So I think he's, and what will happen in Egypt, that's one of the postulations. Things will, I don't know, but at the end of the day, we'll find that he's really crippled inside Sudan only. And we don't know that. It may end by, as she said, I think his own people will hand him over to ICC. That's the only alternative.
I just wanted to make the point that I think in the immediate term, over the past weeks and probably future weeks, it hasn't had an impact on the process. We've seen the AU backtrack from, well, I mean, it always has backtracked, but we've seen renewed statements about supporting deferral, and we've seen France also say it wants to support deferral, and we've seen, powers step away from the ICC, and this is an ongoing debate in the African Union about how to approach international justice. As I pointed out earlier, the AU itself had sponsored the production of this report with the panel that's headed by former President Thabo Mbeki, which includes a lot of recommendations for justice, not excluding the ICC, but also packaging it with much broader reforms, including wholesale reforms of the criminal justice system to make it much more effective in providing accountability. Sudan has not taken a single step to make that happen, only window dressing. So it has appointed prosecutors to go to Darfur and start investigating, but even the prosecutor who was appointed has thrown up his hands and said, I can't get anything done here. Sudan has not taken any action on this, and AU has not pushed it to. Other countries haven't pushed it to. So in the brief response, I don't think it really does figure right now. I think there's a sort of a stepping away from that, but I think it will reemerge as an issue, and it must reemerge as an issue because it's not going to go away. I think what we hear is that Darfuris do care a lot about justice, and that's certainly been the experience I've had in Darfur, various types of justice. So I think it will continue to figure into the equation. The question of whether the South will sign the Rome Statute is very interesting. It will be very telling. I've heard a bit of murmurings about that in Juba over the past few weeks, but I'm not sure. We'll see.
So, Beck, would you like to have the last word?
Oh, and it will. Okay, yes, actually. I would agree that mostly it's internal dynamics that are going to determine Bashir's future. I don't think that you can say that having a leader who cannot travel to certain countries for fear of being arrested is completely irrelevant to how those internal dynamics play out. But overall, in terms of the book, what I want to be very clear about is the message is not the mass movement is evil and we should abandon it. I think it is the most promising, if we take a kind of a really big step back, it's one of the most promising developments that we've seen on the human rights landscape in a very long time. But it's okay to be supportive of the general project whilst being critical of it in specific instances and wanting to push it to think more carefully and to do a much better job going forward than it has done in the past.
Actually, I get the last word, which would be to remind people that the books are back in the corner if you'd like to pick one up, and to ask you to join me. Oh, are you going to take the last word? Well, before I give you the last word, though, let me ask people to join me in thanking the panel.
Jerry, you stole my applause line. But I want to express our deepest appreciation to the panel for a spirited and stimulating conversation. And I also meant to mention earlier our appreciation to Dr. Muhammad for coming down for the day from Boston and to acknowledge that his devotion to his adopted hometown is so pervasive that he apparently refuses to spend the night on our nickel in the Big Apple. But I did want to recognize him for that, and thanks again to all the panel and to all of you for your attendance here and for your good questions. And don't hesitate to pick up the Open Society Fellowship brochure on the way out, and thanks again. Good night.